So we're looking this morning at the passage I read a few minutes ago, Matthew chapter 13, verses 24 to 43. And we have two explicit references in this passage to things being hidden. One is in verse 33, the other is in verse 35. And I think actually it's that concept that holds this passage together, things being hidden. And there are three hidden things in particular to which I want to draw your attention this morning. And first of all then, a hidden explanation. A hidden explanation. And I'm not going to spend long on this because we talked about it at some length last week. But you remember how there we were considering the parable of the sower. And we noted, didn't we, last week, something strange. We noted that the crowd standing on the beach listening to the parable of the sower, the vast majority of that crowd went home without hearing the explanation. All they heard was a little story about a farmer sowing seed. They didn't hear anything about the evil one snatching the word from people. They didn't hear anything about the cares of this world. They didn't hear anything about the deceitfulness of riches. It was the disciples who heard all that after they approached Jesus in verse 10 to quiz him. And we asked the question last week then, was it unfortunate that Jesus used parables rather than plain speech? Was it unfortunate that he employed this indirect, opaque teaching method which only benefited those like the disciples who were willing to probe and pester him and chase down his meaning? Was that unfortunate that he took that approach? And we saw from verses 11 to 16 that no, it was nothing of the sort. It was Jesus' unashamed intention to do that. He wanted to only benefit those who would probe and pester him. That was precisely why he spoke in parables. He didn't wish to throw pearls before pigs. He didn't wish to share precious truths with superficial crowds who didn't value him enough to chase down the meaning of everything he said. Crowds who are willing to just shrug their shoulders and trudge home unenlightened after hearing a bland little agricultural anecdote. He wanted the explanation to remain hidden from such people. So that's what we talked about last week. And I mention it again this morning because Matthew highlights the phenomenon again in this passage that we're looking at now, in connection now, of course, with the parable of the weeds. So we read in verse 24, he put another parable before them. And the them in verse 24 is ambiguous. Jesus has, after all, just been talking to the disciples, so perhaps the disciples are the them. But no, that's not the case, because we come to verse 34, and Matthew tells us all these things Jesus said to the crowds in parables. And then crucially, we're told in verse 36, then he left the crowds and went into the house, and his disciples came to him, saying, explain to us the parable of the weeds of the field. The situation here then is exactly the same as it was before with last week's parable. The crowds hear this throwaway little tale about a crop being sabotaged, and that's all they hear. The explanation is hidden from them, and it's hidden from them because they lack the kind of estimation of Jesus that will make them do everything in their power to access the meaning of his words, in the way that the disciples here do everything in their power to access the meaning of his words. Explain to us, they say, the parable. The crowd don't come saying, explain it to us. The disciples come asking for that. And just like last week then, this phenomenon reminds us this morning that if we are those who come to this book this difficult book, full of complex arguments and layers of meaning. There are things in Paul's letters that are hard to understand, Peter says quite candidly in 2 Peter 3:16. If we are those who come to this book and we don't say, can't be bothered, it just requires too much effort, I'm going to spend my days being spoon-fed whatever drivel I can find on Netflix instead. But we say rather, this is Jesus' book. This is the word of Christ. And if it's his word, I want it. And I want every chapter of it. And I want every verse of it. And I want every proverb to know what that means. And every genealogy to know what that's about. I want to know what it's all about. I want to hear it preached. I want to read books explaining it. I want to grapple with its nuances and engage with its intricacies and uncover its priceless jewels. If we are such people this morning, with an appetite to understand what Jesus is saying that aligns us with the disciples rather than with the crowds, then we certainly shouldn't pat ourselves on the back and become intoxicated with self-congratulation, because at the end of the day, it's all of grace, isn't it, that's the case. But we should be encouraged and we should be thankful that it is so. And so that's just the first thing to flag up here this morning, a hidden explanation. Like the parable of the sower, we have again parables, their explanation being hidden from the crowd because they don't have the appetite to seek out the meaning. A hidden explanation. Notice with me, secondly, a hidden manner. A hidden manner, I mean M-A-N-N-E-R. Verse 35 is interesting. There, Matthew says that Jesus' use of parables, it fulfills a prophecy. And he quotes then from Psalm 78. And look at the quote there. In verse 35, I will open my mouth in parables. I will utter what has been hidden since the foundation of the world. So this is now a different point from the one we've just been talking about. Here it's not that the truths of the parables are hidden from those who don't have the appetite to dig them out. As we've seen, that's absolutely true. But here, it's that the truths of the parables have been hidden throughout history up until now. That's the point in verse 35. That is to say, what the disciples are learning through these parables, because they have the necessary appetites, what they are learning are new truths previously unknown to God's people. Now, at this point, we need to think a bit more about these three parables that feature in our passage this morning. And I want to suggest that the great theme of these three parables is this: the triumph of God's kingdom, which is to say, the triumph of God's king, the triumph of God's king over all that resist him and defy him and are opposed to him. That's the great theme of these three parables, the triumph of God's king. Now, that, of course, is not a new truth. I mean, you can trace that back almost to the very beginning of the Bible itself, can't you? What is that famous first announcement of the gospel in the Garden of Eden in Genesis 3:15? It's the announcement that God's king, the skull-crushing seed of the woman, he will triumph. So these parables in our passage, they're not being novel and original when they tell us that. But then you look at these parables more closely, and you see that the triumph of God's king here, it's a two-sided triumph. So on the one hand, it involves extensive incorporation. God's king incorporating his former enemies into his kingdom as willing subjects. That's the emphasis in the parable of the mustard seed and the parable of the leaven. In the former, Jesus' kingdom is a tree, And we have this suggestive image of the birds of the air coming and making nests in its branches. That image is drawn from Ezekiel 31 and Daniel 4. In both of those passages, the tree is a historical, political kingdom. Egypt in Ezekiel, Babylon in Daniel. And the nesting birds then appear to be other nations incorporated into the powerful kingdom of the day. And from these other nations being incorporated into the powerful kingdom, whether Egypt or Babylon, they kind of derive provision and security from that powerful kingdom. And we may infer here in this parable, similarly, that the birds are the nations being incorporated into Jesus' kingdom and deriving provision and security under his benevolent reign. And then in the parable of the leaven, we have this huge bowl of flour. And the leaven, which roughly equates to the yeast that we use today, the leaven, as it were, brings under its influence that entire bowl. All the flour is incorporated. And again, it's picturing the world, the nations of this world being incorporated into the kingdom of Jesus Christ, coming under his gracious, redeeming influence. So on the one hand, the triumph of God's king involves extensive incorporation, but then on the other hand, it involves devastating overthrow, because not all his enemies come under his gracious redeeming influence. And that's the emphasis in the parable of the weeds. The weeds in that parable represent the sons of the evil one, verse 38, who don't come and bow the knee to King Jesus and avail themselves of the benefits of his reign. And so their opposition to him isn't ended in that happy way through willing surrender. It's ended in a terrible way through them being thrown into the fiery furnace, verse 42, consigned to hell, in other words. A place of weeping and gnashing of teeth. So these parables are clear then. The triumph of God's king, it's a two-sided thing. It involves extensive incorporation and it involves devastating overthrow. But if you know your Old Testament, you'll know that that's not a new truth either. It was anticipated all along. I'll just mention one Old Testament text in this connection. It's Psalm 18. You might just want to turn there for a moment very briefly. And in Psalm 18 then, you have God's king. Okay, perhaps David in the first instance, but ultimately King Jesus. We can say that for sure because it's quoted in connection with him in the New Testament. And in verses 31 to 42 of Psalm 18, this king relates to the nations in terms of devastating overthrow. Let's look from verse 37 onwards. I pursued, this is the king speaking, I pursued my enemies and overtook them and did not turn back till they were consumed. I thrust them through so that they were not able to rise. They fell under my feet. Verse 40, you made my enemies turn their backs to me, and those who hated me I destroyed. Verse 42, I beat them fine as dust before the wind. I cast them out like the mire of the streets. And then you have verses 43 to 45, which are a bit ambiguous. Here we see foreigners kind of come cringing to this king. They come trembling out of their fortresses. Is this still overthrow? Or is this something else? It's difficult to be sure, but then in verse 49, it's definitely something else. Something very different indeed. What's the king doing now? He's not now beating the nations as fine as dust before the wind. He's now leading them in a worship session. This is the bit that's quoted in the New Testament. It's quoted by Paul in Romans 15. He there describes first century Gentile mission in the terms of this verse. He describes it as King Jesus recruiting worshippers. So this in verse 49, it's incorporation now, not overthrow anymore. This is the happy rather than the somber side of the triumph. And so I'm saying in Psalm 18, both sides are there. And Psalm 18 is just one text I've plucked almost at random from the Old Testament. But in Psalm 18, we see both sides of the triumph of God's king clearly presented. And so again, these parables in Matthew 13 are not being novel and original when they tell us that the triumph of God's king involves both extensive incorporation and devastating overthrow. So how are they being novel and original? How, in these parables, is Jesus uttering what has been hidden since the foundation of the world? That's what verse 35 says. How is it so? Well, this is the answer. It isn't the fact of the two-sided triumph of God's king that has been hidden since the foundation of the world. We've clearly seen it's revealed in the Old Testament. Rather, it's the manner of the two-sided triumph of God's king that has been hidden since the foundation of the world. God's king achieves his two-sided triumph in a particular manner that wasn't made known in the Old Testament scriptures, but is made known in these three parables. And that then takes us to our third heading this morning. We've noted a hidden explanation, a hidden manner. Our third heading is this: a hidden triumph. A hidden triumph. You see, it was expected that the manner of the two-sided triumph of God's king would be like this. It would be explosive. It would be spectacular. It would be unmistakable. You think of John the Baptist for a moment. And John anticipated the two-sided triumph of King Jesus, didn't he? On the one hand, Jesus would take away the sin of the world, John said. John's Gospel 1, verse 29. So clearly the nations would be incorporated. They would come under his redeeming, sin-removing influence. But on the other hand, Jesus would cut down fruitless trees and burn chaff with unquenchable fire, John also said, Matthew 3, 10 to 12. That's overthrow, all right. So, just like in Psalm 18 then, both sides of King Jesus' triumph are there alongside each other in the ministry of John the Baptist. But of course, John's situation is unique, isn't it? He's the one Old Testament prophet, if you like, who actually lives to witness, a little bit at least, of King Jesus' activity. And when he does so, what is his reaction? Well, we saw his reaction a few months ago when we were considering Matthew chapter 11. This was his reaction. He sent messengers to Jesus asking, "Are you the one who is to come, or should we look for another?" His reaction was one of confusion and disappointment and feeling let down. Why? Well, presumably because when he had prophesied those things in John 1 and in Matthew 3, he had expected fireworks. He had expected in-your-face blockbuster action on a big scale. And he wasn't seeing that with Jesus. And it isn't because John is just one of those really fiery characters that he thinks like that. We've been studying Daniel recently on Sunday evenings. Now, Daniel is not a fiery character. He's a very refined, intellectual, book-loving kind of guy. And yet you get the same thing with Daniel. Daniel prophesies about this string of beastly empires culminating in that supremely beastly one, the Greek kingdom, which would propel onto the world stage one particularly beastly king, Antiochus IV. But that dreadful period would eventually pass. And there are moments when Daniel looks beyond it and he sees after Antiochus the arrival of the Messiah, and boy, it's big, it's decisive what he sees. The Messiah, according to Daniel, brings in everlasting righteousness, chapter 9, verse 24. He brings out of the dust those who have died, and he makes them shine like the stars, chapter 12, verse 2. So whether it's John the Baptist, or whether it's Daniel, or whether it's Isaiah, we could go to passages of his prophecy and observe the same phenomenon. Whichever it is, this is what was expected about the manner of King Jesus' triumph. It would be grand, it would be conspicuous, it would be attention-grabbing. And this, then, is the fresh contribution that these parables make. They reveal the true manner of King Jesus' triumph. And this is what they reveal. That it's not going to be explosive and spectacular and unmistakable. It's not going to be grand and conspicuous and attention-grabbing. Rather, it's going to have an element of ambiguity about it. So the king comes, and his kingdom is established, and the triumph is set in motion, and yet that isn't necessarily obvious to people. There's a sense in which it's a hidden triumph. That's what these parables reveal. How then? How is it a hidden triumph? Well, in two ways. First of all, the incorporation is gradual. The incorporation is gradual. Because those two parables then that are about the incorporation of the nations into Jesus' kingdom, the mustard seed parable, the leaven parable, yes, there's an emphasis in them on the largeness of the tree and on the completeness of the leavening process. That is to say, many of the nations and much of the world is to be incorporated into Jesus' kingdom. That emphasis is there, but there's also, is there not, a real emphasis on the smallness of the beginnings. That tiny mustard seed. Or that leaven which, when inserted into the bowl, would have seemed minuscule compared to the amount of flour in there. There's a significant emphasis on that. In other words, the nations weren't going to be zapped by King Jesus' saving power in a stroke. The world wasn't going to be Christianized overnight. It would be a protracted process which would inevitably entail this element of hiddenness. I mean, you think of that seed. And there are two things, aren't there, then, about a seed, like the mustard seed Jesus is talking about here. Number one, it grows extraordinarily, out of all proportion to its size. But number two, that growth is imperceptible in real time. I mean, you can sit and stare and stare and stare for hour upon hour upon hour at a plant or at a tree, and you will not observe its growth. I mean, there are some processes, aren't there, in life that you can observe in real time. The tide coming in, perhaps, if you're on a beach. And you can actually watch each wave kind of coming a little bit further up the beach and getting closer to the sandcastle that you've made or whatever. And you can see in real time that this process is happening. It's not like that with a seed, with a plant, with a tree. You can't actually watch it. There are only two ways, really, that you can observe the growth. Nowadays, you can do it by filming it and then putting it onto fast motion, like you see on these David Attenborough programs. Or you can observe it by checking periodically and comparing with the last time you checked. And that way, you can see the thing growing. And Jesus is saying then, the nations will be incorporated into my kingdom extraordinarily, out of all proportion to the humble beginnings of my first advent, my birth in Bethlehem, my death on Calvary, the pathetic little band of disciples I had with me. But that incorporation will usually be imperceptible in real time. I mean, as you and I look at it this morning, as we look at the kingdom of Jesus Christ in this world, and we're conscious of crushing persecution in so many places, and we're conscious of the new colonialism whereby the West exports its secular agenda as far and wide as it possibly can. We can sometimes think, is it really happening at all, this incorporation of the nations into the kingdom of Jesus Christ? But when we compare the situation today to what it was 1,000 years ago or 500 years ago, or to what it was in 1988, Lindsey Brown, who's coming to us in October, he argues that 1989 to the present day has been the greatest period of advance in church history. Then it's perceptible. And we should think in those terms far more often than we do. The incorporation is happening. The tree is getting bigger and bigger. The branches are becoming fuller and fuller of the Gentile birds, the nations of the world. In Psalm 18:49 terms, King Jesus is assembling a vaster and vaster choir of worshippers to join him in praising his heavenly Father. Don't be discouraged. A hidden triumph in its gradually unfolding nature, yes, but a real triumph. Jesus is bringing the nations under his benevolent reign. So, how is the triumph hidden? Well, number one, the incorporation is gradual. But then, number two, the overthrow is deferred. The overthrow is deferred. You know what I mean by that word. We use it in the context of a meeting, perhaps, and you have an agenda to work through, but then you've been in the meeting for a couple of hours and there's still a couple of items left on the agenda. You're too tired to discuss them that night, and so you defer them. Those items are deferred. They're put off until later, put off until the next meeting, until the next agenda is written up. And the point then of the parable of the weeds is that this overthrow of those enemies of Jesus who won't surrender willingly to his reign, that overthrow is deferred. It's not even gradual like the incorporation is gradual. It's simply deferred. It's put off until later, until, we're told in verse 39 and in verse 40, the close of the age. That's the phrase Jesus uses. And as we wrap this up this morning then, I just want us to think about that, and I want to make a few applications. And first of all, I want to apply this to those of you who aren't Christians this morning, those of you who aren't believers in Jesus Christ, those of you who aren't living under the reign of Jesus, who haven't said, Jesus, be my king. And perhaps you're tempted to think that Christianity is a load of nonsense, because you can defy God this morning with apparent impunity. You could do whatever you want. You could shout out, if you so wish, the most blasphemous things about God at this very moment. And you know you wouldn't be struck down. You would walk out of this building and get on with the rest of your day. And so all this stuff about God as a judge and God punishing such behavior, it's a load of rubbish, you're tempted to think. But, you know, the Bible itself makes it absolutely clear that you can live however you want in this life with apparent impunity. That's what this parable is saying. The weeds are just allowed to grow and to be there in the field and to get on with being weeds. And it's not until this deferred overthrow that the chickens come home to roost, that suddenly suddenly the judge confronts those who have lived in this way. So please don't be fooled by the absence of any retribution, any sanctions, any punitive measures from God. You can live your life outrageously and nothing will happen. The Bible itself is absolutely clear. Yes, that will be the case in this life. But there's a terrible day, a day of judgment, a day of reckoning. And it's deferred. It won't happen until the very close of the age itself. But it will happen. Please take that seriously this morning. But then, secondly, I want to apply this to those of you who are Christians, who are believers in Jesus Christ. And I just want to notice three things then as we finish. First of all, a recognition here. A recognition. A recognition that this arrangement, whereby the enemies of Jesus Christ are allowed to carry on functioning with apparent impunity, that arrangement is counterintuitive. I mean, you see that in Psalm 73, don't you, that we sang earlier on. The psalmist struggles with that. Here are these people and they're so godless and they're so degenerate in their lifestyles. And yet they are just allowed to carry on. And he struggles with that. It's a massive problem for him. But here too, in this passage, we get a sense of the counterintuitiveness of it. There in the parable of the weeds, the way in which the servants of the master in verse 27, and we're not told who the servants aren't kind of identified in the explanation of the parable later. They're not the reapers who are identified as angels, or just these servants, they're not identified, but that doesn't matter. These servants, they approach the master in verse 27. They say, "Did you not sow good seed in your field? How then does it have weeds?" Then the master replies, "An enemy has done this." So the servant said to him, "Then do you want us to go and gather them?" That's their instinct. That's their natural reaction. Well, these weeds, they should be dealt with here and now. And it's a recognition then that there is this counterintuitive dimension to the deferment of the overthrow. And if you ever find yourself struggling then, like the psalmist in Psalm 73, it's perhaps helpful and comforting to know that the Bible recognizes the unnaturalness, in a sense, that this goes against the grain of our instincts. Here are these servants saying, "Shouldn't we just sort it out now?" A recognition. And then secondly, a reason. A reason here. Because it's interesting, isn't it, that in verse 29, a reason is given for the deferment of the overthrow. "No," he says, "lest in gathering the weeds, you root up the wheat along with them." In other words, it's for the good of the good seed that the weeds are left. It's for the benefit of the good seed that the uprooting and destruction of the weeds is deferred until later. Now, we can't kind of press verse 29 here as though it's kind of literally saying that, you know, God could not possibly kind of judge the wicked now without also kind of some of his own people getting caught up in the judgment. That God wouldn't be able to do that. Of course, it's not saying that. But there is this general principle. It's for the benefit of God's people that the judgment of the wicked is deferred. And that's not elaborated here, but perhaps we can understand something of the logic of that. Perhaps we can say that living in a world where there is opposition to our King, and where we are surrounded by that opposition day in, day out, and it's in our faces, perhaps we can say that that makes us stronger than we would be were that not the case. I mean, you get a sense of that perhaps in Psalm 73. I began our service this morning with the end of that psalm. And the psalmist crying out, "Whom have I in heaven but you? There is nothing on earth that I desire besides you. My God is the strength of my heart and my portion forever." I wonder whether the psalmist would ever have thought so passionately and so fervently about God if he had not had to go through that struggle. The struggle ultimately brings the psalmist closer to God. And perhaps then one of the reasons, just as God puts trials and problems in our lives to make us stronger, so one of the reasons that the weeds are left until the end is also to make us stronger. We are stronger living alongside them and being confronted by them than we otherwise would be. A recognition, a reason, but then a third thing to notice here, a reality. A reality, because you might think, well, is not all this a bit of a cop-out? It's a bit like, you know, if you have children and they say, you know, what are we going to be doing on Saturday, or what are we having for dinner tonight, and you say, ah, well, it's a big secret, it's a big mystery, whereas really, of course, you haven't worked out yet what you're going to do on Saturday or what you're going to have for dinner tonight. And we could say, well, you know, it's like that. It's a cop-out. Here are the prophets in the Old Testament, and they're prophesying something very dramatic and very decisive and very big scale. And here we are, and we're saying, it's hidden. It's all very hidden. Are we not really just being a bit embarrassed about the supernaturalism of biblical religion? But no, we need to be clear that when that close of the age comes, there'll be nothing hidden then. The hiddenness then will completely be lifted. When the overthrow that has been deferred does happen, it will be dramatic, all right. And not only that, but the thing which Jesus goes on to say accompanies the overthrow, the transformation of his own people, the transformation of the righteous, that will be dramatic as well. In fact, if anything, it goes beyond anything that the prophets anticipated. I mean, think of John the Baptist. And he, as we've said, he talked about our sins being removed. Jesus taking away our sins. He used that kind of language. But Jesus here says that, look, there's something way, way beyond that. It's not only the sins, the guilt, the behavioral problems of my people that will be removed. Ultimately, even the effects of sin in their bodies will be removed, and they will shine like the sun. I think he's talking about resurrection and physical transformation beyond anything we can imagine. This goes beyond. It's not less than what John prophesied. It's more than what John prophesied. Or you think of Daniel, and he talked about God's people, the righteous, being made like the stars, shining like the stars. Well, Jesus goes beyond that. No, it's not just the stars. They'll shine like the sun. And the sun, of course, is vastly brighter than the stars. And so there's going to be drama, all right. There's going to be bigness, all right. Then, on that day, at the close of the age. And I think then, as I've already hinted just now, that when Jesus talks about the righteous shining like the sun in verse 43, I think it is his equivalent of what Paul will talk about in 1 Corinthians 15, the resurrection body that was dishonorable. He says it will be glorious. And that's what Jesus is getting at here, that we will actually shine like the sun. Such will be the splendor and the glory. And perhaps that's where some of you need to hear as we finish this morning. Perhaps you're very aware of fading now. Very aware of your body being on its way out. Very aware that you're losing energy and you're losing capacities and you're losing faculties. And Jesus here is pointing you to a day when you will shine like the sun. You'll be so renewed, so transfigured, so beautified, so glorified, that you will be comparable with the sun itself in splendor and brightness and radiance and glory. And so this is not a cop-out. There will be transformation. There will be fireworks. But it will be then. In the meantime, the triumph is this gradual incorporation of the nations, more and more people coming under Christ's kingship. Amen.